these people have so much karma. So it's all with them. They still have this, they're all packed up tight in their subtle bodies with their karma, waiting for the time of creation. So if we can pregnant them into material nature, where within the womb of material nature, they take birth automatically according to their karma in the different species of life. According to Vedic calculation, the Padma Purana counts 8,400,000 categories of living entities. Prabhupada calls them species, but it doesn't mean the same thing as what is called a species now. So there are very many kinds of aquatics, plants, birds, land animals, so on, reptiles, whatever. 8,400,000. So the blueprints for every living creature is already there in the Vedas. These species are eternally existing, or at least they're prototypes of them. They're not always in manifestation because of time and life. Yeah, but the blueprint for all the species of life, as well as the universe. Because when Brahma, the creator, wants to bring forth all these beings, he becomes, he's called Veda Garbha. He's called impregnated in the Vedas. And that gives him the intelligence to create. He's an engineer. And the Vedas act as the blueprints. An engineer to build something has blueprints. And then he, according to the blueprints, he manufactures the rest of the manufacturer. So this is Brahma's job for the secondary creation. He is educated in Vedic knowledge. And then accordingly, he creates the universe. And in the process of that, all the 8,400,000 species of living beings come out. Why? Because of the karma of the living. According to our karma, we take birth in one of these species. So the reason there is a variety of types of living beings. That there are so many desires that the living entities have. And to fulfill those different desires, that's why there are varieties of insects, birds, plants, aquatics, land animals, and so on. Because each material body represents a certain mode of enjoying material nature. And if you really get into it, and then change it. Well, that's what they're there for, if they even include thousand species of life. So the point is here, he said, it's not that all is evolved. So the activities of the different species of living beings have begun from the very moment of creation. It's not that all is evolved. So this story that Krishna is telling us about. We start with the most real, most perfect living entity, Krishna. And out of him, the sum total of all knowledge and intelligence, this universe is created. It's called, we use the term for Krishna, absolute truth. Technically speaking, the word God is inadequate. It's not really precise. When you're dealing with Krishna, the precise term is absolute truth. Because the word God denotes a controller. So there can be many gods within the controllers. But the word absolute truth denotes the ultimate source of all energies. That from which everything has its origin. So the actual philosophical search for the ultimate truth is aimed at that. From what does everything come? What is the basis of creation? And this is what Krishna is describing here. The whole cosmic order is under me, under my will. It is automatically manifested again and again. And this happens over and over and over and over and over. The universes are produced, the living entities come forth, enact their karma, their destinies, and then at the time, when the day ends, it's all wound up again. Then it comes out again, then it's wound up, then it comes out, then it's wound up. And this is going on and on and on. Like this. By his will, well, it's produced, and another is, well, it's annihilated. To give these living entities all a chance to satisfy their varieties of desires, and also to give them a chance to perfect themselves, to get out of this situation. This is not a good situation of having to be created and annihilated over and over and over again. So the effort of modern civilization, since what is technically historically called in Europe the Enlightenment, unfortunately it has this name, has been to do away with the absolute truth. When you talk about relativism, for example, you're talking about a position where people say there is no absolute truth. That means that the implication of this is that there is nothing from which everything comes. And the whole effort of modern thinking, modern scientific thinking, has really been an ideological program to convince us that there is no absolute truth. So this story they tell, and it's the modern myth. The story they tell is that in the beginning, there's a book that was put out a number of years ago. Actually, it was a sex education book for children, called The Origins of Johnny. And it was very, very explicit. And it was controversial. You had a little line drawings, and Johnny finds out about sex by watching his big sister and boyfriend have sexual intercourse. So it was sort of a very liberal point of view. And so the book ends with sex. It begins with, where does Johnny come from? The book asks. Right? So it starts with the creation of the universe, right? And the book says, in the beginning was the, and there's a blank space on the page and followed by a period. And then it says blank, and then it goes on and kind of says, blank cannot be described, blank has to be. But you see what they've done. Of course, everybody, Christians all know the famous beginning of the Gospel of St. John, the beginning of the Word. So what they did was a deliberate parody of this. And where it said Word, they had logos as the Greek, and it was seminal. It means beta, actually. The beginning of the day is the absolute truth. They have a blank, no word, the absence, void. So that just shows what the ideological program is. What happens is when scientists, by their speculative methods, try to find out what happened at the very origin of the universe, they find out there's a point at which they cannot go any further. They speculate that the origin of everything, as far as they can determine mathematically, was something that has infinitesimal size and infinite mass. For example, it's inconceivable. And to get past that, you know, origin, there's books like Stanley Weinberg, The First 3 Minutes, and all this stuff like that. Because they think that as they accelerate particles in subatomic particles and blow things apart, higher and higher energy physics, the higher the energy gets, the closer and closer they're finding out what's happening with this origin. So this is how they're going to discover what's going on. So there's a point by which that everything just becomes, everything goes haywire. They can't see. They can't know. And this is what you do. You say, oh, well, at this point my knowledge stops, and there's a blank. I draw a blank. Then I say, what's out there is a blank. You see, what you do is you read your own ignorance. It's a reification of your own ignorance. It's just like if I got a 17th century map of the United States, and I can see in the East Coast, and this map is the Allegheny Mountains, there's the rivers, and I get a little past the Mississippi, the map becomes a blank. It's unexplored territory. There's nothing on the map. And I think that actually once I get past the Mississippi, everything's going to vanish. I'm just going to be watching them walking across a featureless plain for miles and miles and miles. The map just tells me about my ignorance. It doesn't tell me it's not present. This is what these people do. It's a blank. Means they don't know. And instead they say, no, it's something out there that's nothing. So then the whole trick, the whole effort is to convince us, and just by saying it and repeating it over and over and over again, is to convince us that basically everything comes from nothing. That there's gradually introduced into this primordial mess of everything completely at random, that and then somehow other things cling together and you get clumps and bigger clumps, and then gradually order emerges out of this thing, and then you get, you know, things going from simple to more complex, to more complex, to more complex, then you get really complex, living entities come up, and then, you know, gradually you get Beethoven and Shakespeare and physicists. And we're supposed to believe this. We're supposed to believe that all of this comes from nothing. And that's what we have to get. All you have to do is accept one thing, that something comes from nothing. Because this is done, the way this is done, as in the basis of Darwinian evolution, or chemical evolution, the introduction of chance. The whole mechanism on which Darwinian evolution is supposed to rest is random mutations that forms the basis on which the natural selection takes place. Random mutation means it causes these things that happen that have no cause. What they do, at least in the more primitive areas, is things are at random, and by chance, order emerges. By chance. And chance means that events take place. A chance, by this they mean, there's something that takes place in the nature of reality that has no cause. I mean, this was all the way back. The Greeks speculate, I think this, the atomic Greek philosopher talked about the swerve in atoms. There's a swerve, and there's all of a sudden atoms moved without any cause. Nothing caused it. It just happened. And that's the view that you have to accept, that you accept as all things, that we are a sheer introduction of novelty without any cause into reality. That's what you have to believe. And based on that, just on things happening without any cause, tomorrow all this water comes out of the mountains. And you hear it, there's something, yes, this comes from nothing, that when you see your television set, you say, where it comes from, no, it just popped out of the void. And basically, that's what they're saying. They're trying to make it look like it, you know, popped kind of gradually out of the void. But what they're saying is that it popped out of the void. You know, it becomes a little less shocking because you have 15 million years for it to pop out. And basically, that's what happens. It just pops out of the void. As I pop out of the void and you pop out of the void, you're there. That's what we have to believe. So if you actually see it, you know, you one intuitively says, this doesn't make sense. But if you keep just repeating it to yourself over and over again long enough, you finally accept it. This is what's happening to people. We don't see anywhere, of course, that anything pops out of the void. We always see that things have causes. And that causes are always greater than their effects. And that if we see this universe, which has so many things in it, so many people and variety of creations, and we ask, where does it come from? It must come from something that has everything that's here. Where does it come from? Whatever is here comes from there, so that must also be there in the absolute truth. This just intuitively seems to be much more reasonable position. But why embark upon this program to try to make it seem reasonable that there is no absolute truth? Well, that's because people, the thrust of modern civilization is basically to turn away from the Supreme Being, turn away from God, to try to explore this universe, engage in sense gratification, think there are no consequences, and so on. It's worth it. And destroying death of God in the last 2 worlds. Everybody's trying to erect a civilization, a modern civilization, on this basis. Completely deny tradition, completely. What's happened is Bhagavad Gita is Veda. Veda means knowledge. But now that we've got, they've safely taken this book and put it in the category of scripture. The knowledge is now in a physics book. This is not knowledge. This is belief, and that's knowledge. And so many fictions have been created like that to neutralize this actual knowledge. Because their method is different from our method, the speculative method by which they find out. But it's an ideology. It's not science. This whole myth that they build up is not science. The base is based on it, it's got an intention. But it's an a priori intention. They decided in the very beginning. It is not that science has disproved an absolute truth or has disproved the existence of God. Science, methodologically, leaves it out of account. The whole effort of modern science is, let's see how much of this world we can explain without taking God into account. That's how they started out. And they revealed themselves at a meeting, I've told this one, some of you heard this story before. There was a meeting of cosmologists in Washington, D.C. a few years ago, and they were discussing the initial conditions of the universe and how everything about. And some gentlemen have presented a paper to show that if the initial conditions of the universe are completely outlandish, there's no way within the 4.5 billion years that things have been existing, there's no way, I guess it's the age of the universe, anyway, whatever the age of the universe is, there's no way that you can get any kind of anything like the amount of order we have. There's just not enough time for the random things to work. But actually, this case can be made. And he made it very well. And so he proposed that the universe, certain things were not initially, the very initial conditions of the universe were not at random. There was, from the very beginning, some order. Had to be, in order to get the amount of order we have now. Had to be. So this was called the stack deck theory of the universe, as opposed to the shuffle deck theory of the universe. So the report I read about, it was in Science News, said that the question came up in the seminar, the symposium, if the deck is stacked, who stacked it? And it said, however, most scientists, and somebody said, God. Because, I mean, that there's the archetypical deck stacker. Immediately, when you get to the first game, that's God. That's what everybody says God is. So somebody said God, and the article said, but most scientists prefer not to take that cop-out route. And that's such a revealing sentence. You see, because that's the game. The game is, and it's a very serious game, is let's leave God out. Let's make an intelligible... See, we have to live our lives in a... We have to put a kind of frame around the universe that we live in. Where we have to know where... We have to have a place in creation. We have to have a map, kind of where we are, a mental image. You know? So what they want to provide everybody with a map or a mental image, which, you know, makes us good consumers, good buyers of VCRs, and which affords our explanations of varieties of sense gratification. So this, if there's no absolute truth, that everything pops out of the void, like we just have a good time and do what I want, and not consider myself held accountable for anything that I do. So they want to provide, so it's a very serious game, and there's a lot at stake at this game. But the game is, so science is in support of a certain style of life, a certain way of living, certain presuppositions about how we should act and what we should do, and so on. So the game is, therefore, we want to explain everything without God. So if you bring God up to them, you just, it's not that you're just blown the game. So when we come and say to a scientist, you can solve this problem, there's God. It's like you were watching some people playing tennis and you notice they're having a hard time bringing the ball across the net. You come and say, look, you got rid of the net. You can make it a lot easier. No, the game is. So this is, it's one of the ground rules of science that God has left out. They start with that intention. So that's built in to what they call science. Not real science, but the whole ideology or scientism, or whatever you want to call it, that's built up out of it, that whole program. So here this is a different picture. This is a different picture. Everything is coming from Krishna. He's creating by his energies. He's maintaining, and everything lines up for him. And the whole universe is produced on his blueprint. Just as anywhere, in fact, anything we see something being produced, it's on somebody's intelligence, somebody's direction. If there's no intelligence and no direction, it's chaos. We would not produce anything like this. We would not build a housing project by taking a bunch of bricks and mortars and boards, putting it in a vacant lot, and blowing it up, and expecting when the dust settles to be a housing project. It doesn't work like that. Things are not how things work. Things work when intelligence is applied to raw materials, and things are created by direction, under supervision. That's the way it happens here, because that's the way it happened in the origin of things. This is a much more reasonable picture. Somehow or other, we don't like the fact that there's one big, categorically great intelligence behind all of this, and makes us very nervous. One of the goals of scientists is to control material nature. Now, material nature is already under someone's control. That's what Krishna's describing here. But Krishna's already under control. How are they going to control it? So, we want to have it. So, obviously, if there's no God, and there's no one in control, and make it, it's easy to hijack material nature and take it over. But if you've already got somebody controlling it, somebody who's powerful enough to control it, obviously, they're not going to be able to do that so easily. So, this is the programmatic intention to really eliminate the God from you. And this is the answer here, Krishna is saying. The whole cosmic order is under me. Under my will, it is automatically manifested again and again. And under my will, it is annihilated. Any questions about that? Yes.
Why does it have to come from anywhere?
Why does it have to come from anywhere? You can believe that if you want. You can believe it just pops out of the void. After all, that's how you work, right? That's how you get things. When you want a new flash attachment to your camera, you just expect the pop out of the void. And it does not produce by little Japanese
people. Because the universe is already there.
Where is it always been there? How do you know it's always been there? I mean, I don't know anything that's always been there. Everything that I know, every part of the universe has an origin. Now, how can you do something that's made up of things that have an origin in itself not have an origin? Where does the energy come from that runs it? What keeps it together? Like my body, there has to be something to keep it running, to keep it going. It doesn't exist in itself, it requires fuel. So everything here is running on the sun. We're all running because we're all getting energy from the sun. Where did the sun get its energy from? Where did that come from? It's supposed to be this big atomic furnace boiling it out. Who started that? You curious at all? So you trace it back. Trace it back to the original primordial Big Bang. And don't you want to know something about where that came from? What it just appeared? And somewhere where there's this quantum mechanic vacuum, and all of a sudden there's this point that's infinitesimally small and has infinite mass and is actually the whole universe, and then it just... Why? Don't you want to know why? Well, he's going to say it just happened. Okay. But there are other people who want to know why. And of course, you can't find out by your speculation. But here's the person who's the origin of that point to tell us all about it. You can't. There's a limit by your speculative knowledge of what you can know. And they run across, scientists run across that limit. We find that this is as far as our, they run across indeterminacy principles and things like that. This is in principle as far as we can go. And this would be because it always happens. It's a speculative knowledge and pushes you again to get into the voice. It always happens. That's what's happened too, you know, big, you know, Tao physics thing. Modern physics, unholy alliance between the Eastern and Mayavadi thinking, Buddhism and modern physics. Some big discovery that, yes, some of the conclusions of modern physics seem like what the Buddhists or Taoists are saying, but it's no accident at all. It's the same process. When you take speculative material knowledge and push it far enough, it comes to the wisdom. So we just do that. Why does the universe itself have an origin? It's not something that you see. Everything you see is material. Material can see it has a beginning and end. So the universe is a combination of a conglomeration of things. Every cell in my body has a beginning and end. And my body is a collection of cells. There's no reason when we say that my body as a whole also has a beginning and end. Nature can be different than the nature of each of the cells. And if it keeps on going, if it doesn't have a beginning, then I want to know what sustains it in existence. Something material needs to be sustained. But ultimately, you come to the self-sustaining being, upon which everything depends, but which doesn't depend on anything. That's the absolute truth.
Question or challenge that whole presupposition that science is based on this idea that eliminates God? Or do they simply see God and religion as simply faith and mythology and a sentimental belief?
Well, scientists who go to church and stuff like that. But they're a product of secularization. And this is what they say. Yes, I believe in God. But as a scientist, this is the key to, but as a scientist, I cannot take him into account. Where is that? If God is the truth, then your science looking at the truth, but now I have to leave him out. Where is that? What is that? As a scientist, I cannot take him into account to you. Or else he doesn't really believe in God. But that's what you have in the modern world. It's kind of, this is what sociologists call secularization. This is a secular society. And I said, people saying it means that there's no religion. No, a secular society, there's a lot of religion. There's churches, people believe in God. But the sphere of religion is limited. It doesn't intrude into the really important transactions like making money, like running a country, like determining what is knowledge, and so on like that. It stays off in the corner. So you get people, you know, who can like, you know, they go home and, you know, they can talk in tongues and a little. weekend and they go into the laboratory and, you know, many people are like, you know, super whiz physicists and the same have Orthodox Jews. And they just have two compartments. And they don't mix. That's how they do it. Did you hear that, Mike?
Yeah, I'm confused about a point where Krishna says there was never a time when we were not. We always were. And yet we're speaking of origins and creation. Now, to create is to bring something into being. If we always were, then why would Krishna have to bring us into being?
No.
If we always were, I can't see how we were created.
We're not. What it creates is the manifest material world and impregnates living entities into that world.
So all this that we see around us in these trees, no, that wasn't always.
Yeah, that keeps coming and going. Everything that's matter keeps coming and going. The living entity stays, but keeps changing the circumstances due to material contamination. Martha?
Yeah, how does the Buddhist void philosophy appeal to physicists?
Well, they think they've run across something like that. When you see an empirical philosopher, when he pushes his method to the limit, what happens is that you run across, it always happens, that no matter which way you approach it, even if you're like somebody in, you know, India 2,500 years ago, or whether somebody has a lot of sophisticated mathematical tools, nevertheless, the speculative process is the same. And that when you come to the end, or try to push back your knowledge further and further and further, you reach a point at which you have to say, this is as far as you can encounter a barrier. Especially when you're looking for the origin of things, you encounter a kind of barrier. And just like the barrier is, yes, there's a point, you know there's a point, and the barrier is that it's infinite in mass and infinitesimal size. You know, something you just can't conceive. And in fact, that paradox of something that is infinite in mass and infinitesimal in size is in fact a description of Krishna. You could describe the Krishna as that way. He has these contradictory. So what they're doing is, see, they begin to get these things that are like point to something very mysterious beyond this barrier. And they know that this void that they reach, it's not like just a kind of ordinary nothing. But also, if you just religious speculators using negative theology, they come to the same kind of voidist conclusion. It's just the nature of speculative knowledge to end up that way. My early introduction to this, there was a philosopher, a great 20th century philosopher, Ludwig Wittgenstein, wrote a very famous book called The Tractatus Logical Philosophicus, and it begins, it has these little propositions. The world is that which is the case. The world is the sum total of facts. It begins like this. And it has eight propositions, sub-problems, and sub-sub-propositions. And it ends with the final sentences, whereof one cannot speak, thereof one must be silent. Very mystical utterance. And he kind of just, you know, come to the end. If there was something in the past which you couldn't speak, you might be satisfied. But it somehow was very important. So this is just the natural place that it ends up at. And they kind of become intrigued by that. What is that? That's infinite in mass and infinitesimal in size. What is this mysterious origin about which we can't know nothing? And then they notice that it begins to, you know, these impersonal descriptions of the absolute truth, people in paradoxes and things like that, and starts to sound wildlife.
what they read in the towers.
Therefore, it must be true that our communities can be on somebody else and confirm the same thing. That's just the nature of empirical knowledge. It always is. Regulation always is in a person.
I have two questions. First one is the purport. Prabhupada says that after creating a different species of lives, he has no connection with them. And unless I'm taking that incorrectly, that's analogous to a deist philosophy where God sets everything in motion and leaves. I don't think that's the case here. You know, I'm wondering if you explicate what his intention was.
Well, it's a little difficult to understand what Krishna is saying here. Well, what he means to say is that his material nature works. The word Prabhupada is talking about avashan automatically. So it does. I mean, his energies are working. But they're always working under his supervision, but it's kind of supervision at a distance, in the sense that, and this will be explained in a couple of metaphors that are given later on, a couple of examples, that of a judge who is, in some ways, he's involved in what's going on in the court. If somebody's being sentenced, somebody's being pardoned, somebody's being fined, the judge is disinterested. He's not involved, although he's doing it. And so in the same way, this material world, things are going on, and there's a procedure, just like in a law course, the procedure is being followed, but the judge himself is neutral. He's aloof. And the other example is that of smelling the flower. Krishna kind of knows what's going on in material nature at a remove. But he's not implicated or wound up or involved in material nature. So what this is saying is that he simultaneously is working under his direction and under his supervision, but at the same time he's detached and he's not implicated. And the living entity, the karma is a law. Karma is a law. And you commit a sinful action or you commit a good deed, then by the law Krishna set up, it's going on. So there is law-like behavior. But nor is it a fact that there's some material creation that is no material.
I have a comment in regards to your discussion and what the material scientists are saying. One comment is you continue to refer to them as they, implying that there's a group out there, they, and they all adhere to the same principle. I know myself. Talking to scientists who, these serious scientists, people that seriously adhere to scientific method as a tool for investigation, to the knowledge, things that are going on now, trying to understand. Most of the sincere scientists that I've spoke to will admit that they're not trying to make a statement about or necessarily understand absolute truth by the investigation, or rather that they're trying to make inquiry into relative knowledge based on things that are already known and explicated from them. For example, in reference to the Big Bang Theory, many scientists will say that based on what they know about the Earth, the formation in the universe, and how the universe is carrying on at this point, that a new scientific method to extrapolate from that we expanded that it must have originally emanated from one point, but not all of them are saying that that one point popped out of nowhere. They're simply providing a theory or explaining why the universe is in the position that it is in now. And I think one has to be careful of when making references to a group of people in such a way as they're doing that, because in the same way the public will make references, for example, to devotees and say that they do this and they do that, when that may not be true. So my point is that not all of the material scientists are saying that they understand or know or experience absolute truth, but rather are using scientific method to understand relative truth.
It's funny because when you read like scientific journals and articles and so on, when they say like that, then you sit down and read a 10th grade textbook, boy, and all that humility is gone. I mean, there's some truth to what you say, but they also present a united front. And as I said, you know, you introduce God into these discussions, you watch what happens. You watch what happens. You'll be tarred and feathered and run down the rail. And that happens too. That happens too. A scientific, individual scientist may be one thing, but they're very careful about what they publish. And they're very careful about adhering to a certain orthodoxy in their statements. And I think those are some conference. What is the National Association for the Advancement of Science? What is it called?
AAS
conference. I don't know if you can load this thing. And you know, see what happens when somebody brings up something relatively innocuous like parapsychology or something like that, you know. And definitely there's a it's funny, it's people may, as individuals and things like that, they may be all right, and they, you know, they perform these, you know, all kinds of qualifying statements, just like you did. But then they get some total effect when they start to work with it. And sometimes it's not the scientists themselves, but the people who do things with it. Like, where do they come up with philosophical behaviorism? They came up with this idea of working. You know, some people in the artificial intelligence lab at MIT decide that you know, to write consciousness out of the universe. They just wrote it out of the universe because you can't deal with it scientifically. This has been done. And it's kind of, you know, the cutting edge of things. But there's not a lot of people that like that, but, you know, things like that happen all the time.
You just said that. I can say an example. Dr. Robert Jastrow, okay, very, very noted astrophysicist, director of Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland. And for years, he took the structuralist, mechanistic viewpoint as far as science was concerned, that matter was all that there is no God. But Robert Jastrow, being a man of great integrity, 3 years ago, he decided that when he really looked at his equation, he looked at the universe, he said, there has to be a God. There is a God. As far as, you know, his character and, you know, specifics about God, he doesn't know. But he published a book and stating that he now believes in God. And Robert Jastrow is really welcome now in a lot of scientific circles. And this is one of the greatest astrophysicists that we have, you know, in this century. And just simply because he believes in God now, there's this, you know, big prejudice against him. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think there's an establishment that tends to be like that. I can tell you some more stories too. I mean, I know what Sadhguru's going through, trying to like introduce certain ideas. You know, how delicate, because what he wants to do is ultimately use mathematics to show how mathematical science and theory of evolution doesn't work. And you think because just if, you know, it's not, you're not open-minded to it at all. It's a dogma. And he knows exactly what he's up against in order to present something like this. And what he really has to do is kind of introduce into the scientific literature all of his methodologies and various different pieces of his argument. I hope nobody notices what happens when you put the whole thing together. So it's all been accepted piecemeal. You put the whole thing together and draw logical conclusion that evolution couldn't possibly take place. By a so-called chance, and by then, you know, we'll be able to.
Voice to the wrong.